This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done and endured incredible things for the sake of our freedom. And we're going to meet one of those fine gentlemen today, a member of the Greatest Generation. Each week we visit with our veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and certainly inspired by these stories from our Greatest Generation. And we're going to hear a Navy story from World War II. We're also going to hear about a recent honor flight experience with Utah Honor Flight, because Fred Roberts has made Ogden, Utah his home for the last 42 years with his wife of 65 years, Mary. She's here to keep him honest just in case. And Fred, this is beautiful territory. I think I came right up your street to do a hike to a waterfall here a few years ago. I don't think I'd try that this time of year, though, huh?
No.
A little too cold for that.
Well, actually, you'd be better off now than you would if it was a lot of snow up there trying to make it.
Good point. But I think I'll wait for, you know, springtime or summer here in Ogden, Utah. Beautiful city on the, what do they call it, the Wasatch Front?
Wasatch Front.
All right, I'm glad I got that right. But this is a long way from home for you growing up. You were born in Georgia but grew up in the East Bay of California. Graduated from McClimans High in Oakland. What kind of tricks were you up to growing up as a young man in the East Bay?
Well, not much of anything. I was too busy trying to go to school and work. And actually, out of that school, there was only two or three guys that had cars, and I was one of them because I used to work after school doing the cleaning up buildings.
And I said graduate because I slept. I forgot that Uncle Sam got you before you could get that diploma. But I'm curious. I mean, that is a Navy town. I understand that. But I'm sure you had some ambitions, some dreams before World War II broke out and that took you away. Did you have something that you were thinking, this is what I'm going to do with myself?
Well, actually, no, because I went to work when I was about 14. I was working as a doorman at a theater. I worked as a clothing store, and I worked part-time in the shipyards at that time. You know, they couldn't get people to, you know, enough people to do the jobs. So then my friends were all going in the service. So I told my dad that I wanted to go in the Navy because my friends were going in the Marines and the Army, and they were telling me about eating out of cans and crawling through mud. And I thought, I don't want to do that, so I thought I'd join the Navy because I'd have a bunk and something to eat. Mm-hmm. Little did I realize that once that ship gets out in water and something happens to it, you're not going to crawl through mud or eat out of cans. You're gone.
And you were face-to-face with that reality, I know, on several occasions. I want to ask you before we get too deep into your Navy experience, because everyone seems to have this memory, and you were a much younger man. In fact, you were just 15 at the time, but December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were that day and how you found out about the attack?
We were in school, and they called us in the auditorium and told us about it. And I think that's where we heard the President Roosevelt talk about it, you know, about...
Yeah, because that was the day after the attacks. That was December 8th, a Monday, and a lot of schools did that. They brought everybody in and plugged the radio in, and you heard President Roosevelt say, a day which will live in infamy.
Live in infamy.
Did that make an impact on you at the time?
Not really, because the only thing that you were worried about, are they going to come over here?
Yeah.
And at that time, they had knocked out our fleet except for carriers, which were out.
Right.
And they didn't catch those. And I've heard stories and stories and stories about if the Japanese hadn't pulled back, they could have come to the United States because we didn't have any defenses whatsoever. We didn't have hardly any troops or anything.
And you didn't know whether they were coming or not. So no, the Bay Area was a place where there was a lot of tension at this time.
Yeah, really.
And then, as you explained, you decided to join the Navy as opposed to the Army or the Marines. So you get into the Navy, and wasn't exactly what you expected? You didn't think they're going to send you up to snowy Idaho to train, or what?
I didn't even think about it. I know they just sent me up there. And then after I got through boot camp, I was in Camp Ward. They gave me 2 weeks leave to go home, and then they sent me back to Farragut, and then they sent me to Treasure Island. And I was on there, and they assigned me to a ship. And so my family lived in the Bay Area. So I asked for leave since they'd assigned me to a ship, and we knew we were going to go out. And they gave me my Liberty card and everything. And so I went home on the weekend.
Right.
When I went back to Treasure Island, there was a different lieutenant on, and he told me I was AWOL.
Uh-oh.
And I told him, no, I'm not AWOL, and I brought out my Liberty card and the chit that you have. As a penalty, I guess they called it, they took me off that ship and put me on another ship, the Putnam.
Right. Also a destroyer. A
destroyer. But, you know, I can't remember the name of that ship, but it was lost without a survivor. So, I wasn't, of course, I was lucky there. And then I went to boot camp, came back, and then we went on a shakedown cruise towards San Diego. And I had a busted appendix, so they had to send out a plane to pick me up. They put me on what they call a whale boat.
Right.
And they took me over to the plane, which was a PBY, and they flew me to Goleta. There was a Marine base there, Port.
Yeah,
I can't remember the name.
By Santa Barbara?
Yeah, Santa Barbara.
Port Hueneme, maybe.
Yeah, and yeah. And so they operated on me, of course, and then they sent me to San Diego, and I got lost in the records, and I couldn't find a ship. They couldn't find me, and so I was in town, and these guys came up and said, where you been? And I says, I've been right here in Camp Elliott, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to get back on the ship.
So it just happened the Putnam hadn't left San Diego yet. And
no,
you were,
hadn't left.
You were able to reconnect.
Yeah.
Well, and you just described that all matter of fact. But burst appendix, that doesn't sound matter of fact. That had to hurt. That could kill you.
Well, I don't know if I should say this or not, but we had a doctor I didn't trust. And I wouldn't let him operate on me. And so what they did was they doped me up, and they put me in, I called it a casket. It was one of them iron things they put you in and tie you in. And they took me out to the plane, and the seas were fairly rough. And they started to put me up in, and then they pulled away, and the guy was inside, and he was holding on to me. Otherwise, I would have gone. When the whale boat came back on, they shoved me in, and that's when the plane took off. And the pilot, by the way, got an award.
An award for rescuing you?
Yes. Uh-huh. I should have got the award.
You had some hairy moments and some close calls before you got anywhere near the battles of the Pacific.
Yeah, evidently. Yeah,
yeah, pretty wild. So I that makes me wonder what your mindset was like as you guys sailed out of the Golden Gate and headed overseas.
Well, you know, that's part of what you don't remember a lot of, because there were so many things to do. See, I went on the ship as what they call a plank owner, and that's the ship has just been dedicated and everything.
Yeah.
And they put a crew on board to do work, like store stuff and do everything else. And so I was one of the first man on the ship there. It's and they call that a plank owner.
Yeah, it's a brand new ship, a brand new tin can.
Tin can.
All sparkled up, huh?
Yeah. And they put a big sign up back, tin can, like a, you know, like a sardine can.
Yeah.
That was our ship's emblem, tin can.
A tin can on a tin can. And what were your duties on the Putnam?
Well, at first I was just, you know, I was only 18, and I tried to put in for schools, but there wasn't evidently any openings or anything else. So I just went on as a seaman. And then later on, you know, we had duties and everything. Later on, they had an opening up in the Radio Shack.
The timing of this interview is interesting because within the last week, it was the 70th anniversary of the start of the Battle of Iwo Jima. It was also somebody's birthday. I think you just turned 89 a week ago. But Iwo Jima is a place that I'm sure you had never heard of until you pulled right up alongside it in the Putnam, huh?
They had us on deck, and they said that we had an assignment, but they wouldn't tell us what it was. You know, I didn't know where Iwo Jima was. I had no idea where we were at. When we got off and we started bombarding, we would go up and down, you know, and bombard. And they were so entrenched in caves and everything else that we couldn't hardly do anything.
So where would you be when that was going on? You guys are just off the shore of Iwo Jima, and your ship's guns are firing away at Mount Suribachi and all these positions, and where were you?
At that time, I was a powderman, a 5-inch 38 gun. On those guns, you have a powderman and you have a shellman, and I was the powderman, and it would come up and you'd put it in. And it was later on I got in the Radio Shack after
mm-hmm.
that.
What does that sound and feel like when you're next to a 5-inch gun and it's firing?
Those 5-inch 38s, they didn't boom, they cracked almost, you know, it's just like a crack. They had the battle wagons out for the cruisers, destroyers.
Right.
And they were all shooting, you know. And so you really didn't have much time to think, because what you did, you just did your duties at the time.
I want people to understand what it was like to be there, because there's very few people that could tell us that, especially that are still with us today, that can tell this story. So you say you're a powder man on this 5-inch gun, and these guns are going and going and going. I imagine this is pretty nonstop duty for you?
Sometimes you were on general quarters for a couple of days, and they would bring you sandwiches up to the gun and that and everything.
And how often do you need to put the powder in?
Well, whenever you were firing, as soon as the gun went off, you put another powder in, and then the guy put the shell in right after you.
So this is one after another after another?
Yeah, one right after the other, yeah. And on our ship, we had twin 5-inch 38 guns. Some of those ships were single mount. We had twin mounts.
And do you ever have occasion to see where your shells are hitting, if at all?
Not in a gun, no. You're in a turret is mm-hmm. where you are.
Your shells are going out. Are there any shells coming in?
Yes, they're shooting back. They were in caves with big guns. They were shooting, and they hit a destroyer behind us right on one of the turrets. It went over us and hit that destroyer. But other than that, we weren't hit at any time or another, but they were shooting at you.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't get hit, and we were lucky in that respect.
What was that like? I mean, here you are, and you actually had your 19th birthday in the days leading up to Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
So you're a teenager,
yeah,
and you've never been in anything like this before.
No.
And the destroyer behind you is getting hit.
And other ships were getting hit.
And other ships are getting hit, and I'm sure you know that there's all kinds of Marines who are getting mowed down as they hit the shore.
It was... It's hard to talk about that.
I imagine.
The Japanese were so entrenched that the only thing they could do was get on those beaches and try to get up there. And they were being mowed down. Things like that are hard to talk about.
And hard to see when you're 19 years old and you realize that could be me over there.
Yeah. Somebody asked me one time, are you scared ever? And in my case, I never had time to be scared because I didn't have enough sense to be scared. I was only a teenager, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to die. I'm invincible, you know. But then when you see other people dying, it changes your attitude.
I imagine so. And you mentioned Mount Suribachi before the flag. I've talked to a lot of people who saw that flag, whether it was the first flag or the second flag or both, from a lot of different vantage points. Could you see it from where you were?
We could see the mountain.
Yeah.
But we actually couldn't see if they were raising the flag or not because, like I say, I was on a gun in a turret.
Right.
But they took pictures, and it shows the mountain there. Actually, in the pictures taken from quite a ways, I don't know if you can see if there was a flag or not in that.
It's a picture taken from your ship.
My ship, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I've talked to a lot of guys who, whether they saw the flag go up or not, they heard about it.
Yeah.
And it became a pretty big deal. Was that a big deal on your ship?
It was kind of a morale builder because that meant that the Marines were making headway. And once they got that flag up, we all thought that the island was secure, but it wasn't. It wasn't.
It was
a long way from it, yeah. But we were there, and then that was when they brought Forrestal on board. And we left before they had secured the island. And after that, we escorted the troop ships, and we went to Okinawa.
Right. Well, let's talk about what you just mentioned there. And folks who don't know, James Forrestal at this point is the Secretary of the Navy. And you're a little destroyer. You're the expendable ship. You're the one that they don't mind. You're running picket duty to protect the ships they care more about. And here this little old tin can gets the Secretary of the Navy on board? That must have been quite the hubbub.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, it was. And one of the reasons why I think that we might have got that is our gunnery officer was named Isaac J. Kidd, and his father was killed at Pearl Harbor on the Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, I don't remember if he was an executive officer. He's passed away now. We used to call him and talk to him. But they brought him on, and a destroyer is one of the fastest ships out there. And we headed for Guam at flank speed, which was about 30-something knots.
Mm-hmm.
And we got him out of there. And then after we went to Guam and dropped him off, we went back. But we didn't go to Iwo Jima. We headed for Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we bombarded. And then they would send us out what they call radar picket. And what they would do, they would send destroyers and other ships out there, and mostly destroyers, to warn the island that the Japanese were sending planes in. We were miles out, you know, on the past the island.
Right.
We would radio back, and of course, them planes were trying to, that's when they started the suicide bombing. The planes were trying to knock you out so you couldn't warn the island.
Well, and you mentioned Forrest all aboard, and the fact that the Putnam had the duty to take him. I guess otherwise you guys would have been stuck off of Iwo Jima for a while longer, increasing the chances you could have been hit.
Yeah.
So maybe that was fortunate that you had to take him. And you had another bigwig that came aboard your ship that folks will recognize his name. Admiral Nimitz, did you
Nimitz,
say he came on your ship too?
Yeah, and he came on board to escort Forrestal off. And Nimitz came on board, and of course we had an inspection. You know,
I was going to say, I bet people tighten up a little bit when you've got that kind of brass on board.
Yeah, there was no dirty decks or anything like that at that time.
Uh-huh. You get a little nervous?
No, didn't have time. You know, I never got scared ever out there that I know of. And like I say, I didn't believe that I would ever get killed or anything. You know, I was just a kid, and all I was doing my duty.
Well, you'd already been in a coffin.
Touche.
And on that note, we better take our first break. 89-year-old Fred Roberts of Ogden, Utah is our guest today. When we come back, the specter of kamikaze attacks. What impact would that have on Fred and the crew of his destroyer, the USS Putnam? Also, what he witnessed that so powerfully illustrates courage and selflessness in battle. And how a trip to the National World War II Memorial with Utah Honor Flight helped put it all in perspective. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Fred Roberts, 89 years old, born in Augusta, Georgia, raised in Oakland, California. He spent his last four decades in Ogden, Utah. We've heard a little bit about his time on the destroyer, the USS Putnam, and his first taste of action on a 5-inch gun crew bombarding the island of Iwo Jima. It would be off of Okinawa a few months later in 1945 that Fred would come up close and personal with the phenomenon of the kamikaze attack. And Fred, you guys came pretty close to being hit by a kamikaze.
More than once, because they would dive at you. I think at one time we knocked five or six planes out. And I don't remember the period that it was. It was, we were out on radar picket.
So when you're on radar picket, as you described it, you're kind of an early warning system for everybody else. So it's you and other destroyers spaced out.
Spaced out, yeah.
And you see these planes coming in, and you're on one of these guns? You guys are trying to take out those planes with your guns?
Well, actually, at that time, I wasn't on a gun. I was up in the radio shack, and you could see them, and you could hear what was going on. I know that we were coming in. They had what they supposedly was a safe harbor between two islands there. And we were coming in from radar picket with a destroyer called the USS Twiggs. And they were about 500 or 600 yards behind us, or maybe a little more. And all of a sudden, it just blew up. It just went up in flame.
Torpedo.
Nobody really knows that I know of. Some people say a torpedo, some people say a mine, some people, I don't know. But it just went up, and of course we stopped, and we started pulling the guys out of the water. And I think out of 360 approximately men, there was 114 that were saved. And Moncrief, our chief, saved 14 of them, I think.
And you were actually in the water, too, trying to help these guys up?
Well, I jumped in, and I tried to push guys up. People were up there on the decks pushing up, you know, and everything. When something like that happens, you just react. I mean, you can't say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. You just react to what the situation is. And the situation was trying to get those guys out of the water, the flaming water. And a lot of them were brought on board with terrible wounds and that. And we had a doctor at the time. They cleared the wardroom. They operated on what they could in the wardroom on a table there. But you can only do what you're supposed to do or what you think you should do. And a lot of times it's just reaction, you know, you do things instinctively, you know. And in that case, that's what it was, trying to save those seamen.
So this is a destroyer just like yours.
Yeah.
It gets blown up, basically. There's
blown up.
Flames everywhere. Oil is burning in the water.
Yep.
You don't know if they're... You know, if this was a torpedo plane that hit them, you don't know if there's more in the area, if there's more kamikazes coming.
Well, it wasn't a kamikaze, I don't think, in that, because it was kind of dark when we were going in. And
All you know was that this ship was burning.
It was destroyed.
And there's sailors all over the sea.
Yeah.
But, and you say, you know, you jump in. You make that sound like, you know, you jumped off the side of the pool or off a diving board or something. It's not easy to get from the deck of the destroyer into the water, is it?
Not really. You try to get up any way you can, and they were putting things over. But I wasn't in the water that long. I just went in and got a couple of guys, you know, one guy or two guys, whatever I could do, and then I got back up on deck because they were full of oil, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I started pulling them up when they were handing them up and everything. And I don't remember how many guys were in the water at all. And I wasn't in there that long. And then you went up there to try to carry them to places, you know, where they could be worked on. I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly.
Well, I think
not,
you're doing a good job. And forgive me for being over persistent here, but I just think most people have never lived through an experience like this. And I want them to understand what it was like. So these guys are in the water. Some of them are burnt. Some of them may be wounded. They're covered with oil.
You didn't look at that. Some of them you wouldn't have recognized anyhow because they were full of oil. You didn't look at that in that respect. You just were trying to save people.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't stop to say, you know, well, this is this guy, this is this guy. Or you were just doing what you could. Most of the things I did at that time was just help carry them to where they could be put down and, you know, and taken care of. That's what I was doing.
And I'm just putting two and two together here, and only you can tell me. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but something tells me in a war where there's so much destruction and you've seen so many things that you'd never seen before, that opportunity to help save some other sailors' lives had to be one of the more satisfying things that you did.
Well, you know, when I went in the Navy and when I was serving my time, I never thought about anything like that. I was just a teenager, and I had gone into service because we were attacked, and I was just trying to help my country. I never had time to think about like when we were engaged, you know, like we would go out for mines and things like that. And you were just doing your duty. And at this time in my lifetime, I don't remember what some of my thoughts were.
What about now? Is that pretty satisfying to know what your ship did in that situation?
Yeah. I'm not into this rivalry between the services. I don't think like that. And I just look at it this way. We all had a job to do, and you did your job, and you had unity at that time between the services. You didn't have any arguments, battles, or anything like that between, you know. If I'd have been older, I might have had different thoughts. Because a lot of those guys, you know, they were older. They were worried about their families. I didn't have anything but my mother and dad and brothers and sisters, you know. But they had children.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them were thinking different than I would think.
That's a good
and
point.
At the time, I was just trying to do what I was supposed to do. And I had listened because... You know, I love my country, and I still do.
One more question about the rescue of all these sailors from the twigs. In reading about that, a sentence that I saw that makes me wonder, says, Exploding ammunition made rescue operations hazardous.
What it did, from what I understand, it hit the magazine. It was a magazine that was going off.
So while you guys are pulling people out of the water.
Shells were going off, yeah.
In a very unpredictable fashion. You don't know where it's coming from and where it's going.
No, it was just flames and noise is what it was.
And you still weren't scared?
No. Mary will tell you, I'm not a scary guy. And I'm emotional. Yeah. I'm really an emotional person, you know, and I'm impulsive, but I'm not scary.
And I don't want to make you emotional, but something happened right before that. Here you guys are saving all these sailors whose ship was blown to bits, but just hours before, your ship was almost hit by a kamikaze.
Yeah.
Tell us how that kamikaze was denied, what its goal was.
Well, you know, you don't know what that pilot was thinking.
Tell us what happened. So a kamikaze is making a beeline.
A kamikaze was coming in, and he dived into it and smashed into it and put it out of commission. You know, he put it down. And you don't know whether he was wounded or he didn't have enough gas to get back or he just did it out of bravery. And because you'll know
But the bottom line is, this kamikaze was seconds away from hitting your ship.
Yeah.
And what would have happened if it hit your ship?
Probably got sunk us, or really we'd have been sunk or hit or damaged beyond, you know, and you don't
At
know.
At best, you would have had a real bad fire and damage on your hands, right?
Yes, because some of them destroyers were hit for 3 and 4 planes that didn't sink.
But it would have been bad news.
Bad news.
And out of nowhere, this American pilot, which probably isn't easy to do to time this upright, he crashes his plane into the kamikaze. He kamikaze'd the kamikaze.
Yeah.
And gave his life in the process.
Right.
How many men do you think he saved by sacrificing himself?
I think we had 360 men on that ship. I always say that it was a man a foot, 360-foot ship, 360-foot men. You had 1 foot.
Uh-huh. Deluxe accommodations.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of ships were hit and sunk with one plane. A lot of them took 4 and 5 planes. Like they had a destroyer, the Hadley, I understood, 5 or 6 planes, and it was still afloat. Mm-hmm. And my brother-in-law said that his ship was hit with 4 planes, and it was sunk. I just can't think of what, other than the fact that this man saved our lives. I put it that way because we could have been sunk or we could have been, you know, survived, but you don't know. You don't know how much ammunition that plane had, bombs or whatever it had on it, you know. And I remember seeing those carriers hit, and they were just big flames that go up on them and everything, you know, because some of those planes had bombs, and they just had enough gas, from what I understand. They couldn't go back. They had to dive. And because they couldn't get back to Japan.
Well, and I guess part of the tragedy of this situation is that pilot was never identified.
Never.
Don't know his name, which let me come back to that later with some of your recent adventures. But just in that moment, and I don't want to preach at you, but a verse from the Bible comes to mind where it says, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend.
Yeah.
That pilot laid down his life for all of you.
Yeah, he did.
Is that heavy for you?
Yeah.
To think about?
I'm kind of which way about it. Would I have done that? Mm. You know, would I have tried to do that? Or try to ditch the planes and have somebody pick me up?
Mm-hmm.
See, he had two choices, either do that or ditch the plane. Then we would picked up a lot of pilots that didn't make it onto the carriers because they were shot up and everything, and we'd have to go out there and pick them up in whaleboats and that. When you ask me a question, sometimes I have thoughts. What would I have done?
Sure.
You know, would I have gone into saving that ship or would I have ditched the plane and tried to have somebody pick me up? In this 70 years, Mary will tell you, I think about things in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I always have. Well, one of the things is I'm glad I survived and I'm glad our ship wasn't hit. And we were one of the 5 destroyers, I understand, that wasn't hit. And it was just pure luck.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because we did anything wrong. I mean, you know, tried to get away. We were because we were right in there.
You know, and a thought just occurred to me, too, about that June 16th situation where that American pilot saves you from the kamikaze, and then a few hours later you guys rescue all the sailors from the twigs. Not only did that pilot save your ship, he saved those guys from the twigs because you guys wouldn't have been there to rescue them.
That's a good thought because I hadn't thought about it that way. I haven't joined the pilot and the twigs in my thoughts. you know.
Yeah.
And you brought it up, and that's the truth. And maybe that was something that should have happened in a way. You know, you hate to see a man die, but also you hate to see a whole crew gone.
So you guys go through all of this. You've still got Okinawa going on. When the war came to an end, was there some celebration on your ship when you learned that the Japanese surrendered?
Well, I've got pictures in that book, and we were anchored with a Pennsylvania, which was a battle wagon.
Yeah.
And the day they announced the surrender, that battle wagon was hit. And we still don't know it. Probably a torpedo. We're not sure. And they were trying to save that. So it was mostly worried about that Pennsylvania from sinking and trying to do what we were supposed to do rather than celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we did celebrate, you know. I mean, we congratulated each other on that, you know. But we were glad the war was over because it was getting pretty scary out there, you know. And
you tell me, but I have a feeling that you had some maybe even potentially scarier moments to come, because you can see the enemy and you can fight the enemy, but it's kind of hard to fight the weather, isn't it?
You mean the typhoon?
Yeah.
I think that's when I was more, if I wasn't scary, but I think I was a little scary on that, because we would go in and the ship would come up like this, and it would go down, and the waves would come over the top of the ship, and that it's like those rogue waves almost, you know. And if you'd have lost power or anything and you got sideways and, you know, you were tipping over.
So where were you while all that was going on?
I was in the Radio Shack, I think, at that time.
There were probably worse places to be, but I want to clarify, this was a different typhoon, not the infamous Typhoon Cobra or Halsey's Typhoon, which sank the USS Hull, the USS Monahan, and the USS Spence, and claimed the lives of nearly 800 Americans in December of 1944. The typhoon you were in was after the war was over, mid-September 1945, and by 3 days before Christmas, you would be all the way back to the States in San Diego. What was it like to come home after all of that?
We came home and we came into San Diego. And then from there, we went through Panama Canal. And we were assigned to the East Coast, Brooklyn Navy Yard. I could have been discharged in California, but they kept me on the ship. And they took me to New York to be sent on a train clear across country, believe me.
In the military's infinite wisdom, huh?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, they were going to torture me.
Did you ever get yourself in any trouble?
I beat up a guy one time and mouthed off. And so, but other than that, I don't think I ever got it. I wasn't a troublemaker. I did what I was supposed to do. And
what did he say to set you off?
He started talking about family, and I told him to shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't shut up. And so I smacked him and broke his nose. And it happened to be right under the Commodore's quarters.
Uh-oh.
And so they had me up. Isaac J. Kidd was in his little cubicle, and they had us up there. And they absolved me of anything because I had witnesses that what he had mouthed off about. And he's the one that got the warning and a broken nose.
Yeah, I hope he learned his lesson.
See, I wasn't one of these guys that call people names or anything else. And and I'm not one of these guys that I've never been the type of that would pick on people or be derogatory in any way. I joke and kid a lot. But it will never be against anybody. It's always against me.
And you said about yourself earlier that you're an emotional guy. Was it emotional to get back home and see your family again?
It really was. It really was. Because, you know, towards the last, as I got a little older, I got to thinking, you know, that I could have been killed out there. Just was not only me, but other guys too, you know.
Yeah, and in your case, you never would have met your wife of 65 years now, Mary. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll find out how Fred and Mary met and an experience they got to share in the past year that added a lot of perspective to everything Fred endured during World War II. If you'd like to see a photo of Fred and Mary or other pictures pertaining to Fred's Navy service, hop on Facebook and punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. Hometown Heroes will head down the home stretch right after this.
You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf, And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation this week with Fred Roberts, 89 years old of Ogden, Utah. I want to thank Mike Turner, chairman of Utah Honor Flight, for connecting me with Fred. Utah Honor Flight took its first contingent of veterans in October 2013 and has since flown two other groups of World War II vets to Washington, D.C. to see their memorial. In fact, that's Utah Honor Flight's motto, their memorial, our mission. It's part of the National Honor Flight Network. There's a hub in every area where Hometown Heroes is heard. So to find the one near you, go to honorflight.org. We're going to talk about that trip as Fred experienced it. But first, we need to hear the story of how Fred, after surviving some close calls in the Pacific on the destroyer USS Putnam, how he met his wife of 65 years now, Mary.
When I got out of the Navy, I went to work, and then they used to have dances, big bands in the Bay Area. They had the Sweets Ballroom, they had Sands Ballroom, they had the El Patio in San Francisco. So I met this guy, and he used to, there was a whole group of them that would go to these dances, and you didn't dance with anybody else but within this group because they had the women in too, you know. And so I started going to these dances, and so I would go to dances six nights a week.
Wow.
And then on the seventh night, I went to the show, by the way, and I broke the routine. And Mary had a friend. I'd been going about 2 years. And Mary had a friend named Connie, and I had taken her out several times, but nothing serious. And so one day, Connie brought Mary up to the dance. So I saw Mary. I just liked her, you know. But she wouldn't go out with me because she said I was kind of nutty, too crazy at the time, you know, just like the rest of them guys. So she came up one night, and she was sitting there, and they had this bench. And I just walked over and sat down beside her, put my head in my in her lap, and started talking to her.
Pretty bold move.
I was desperate. So anyhow, Connie says, oh, don't worry, Mary, it's just only Fred. So then we started going together, and I think we went together 3 months, wasn't it? 3 months, and a preacher came and said he needed some money, and so he says, I'll marry you for $10, so that's...
Here comes that sense of humor coming out again.
So anyhow, we didn't really propose or anything, did we? We just decided to go to a church, huh? We just decided to go to church and get married, and that's what we did. No big hullabaloo about it. We just loved each other, right?
And 65 years later, you're still going.
Yeah, she is.
What's the secret? I think there are a lot of people out there who say, man, I'd love to have our marriage last 65 years. You have any big words of wisdom for us?
I do. One thing, like I say, I wasn't the most stable guy after I got nervous. I think I was having some problems. So when we got married, Mary's the one, and she saved my life, I think. I tell people, I don't mind telling them, she saved my life. We just kind of talked about things, you know. We never really got into big bad stuff as far as a marriage goes, you know. And Mary's been understanding, and she's held out, and she changed me, you know, from what I was.
And I don't want to pry, but when you say she saved your life, you're saying that you had anxiety or stress from your time in World War II that you were dealing with mentally and emotionally?
Well, I think part of it wasn't, don't you think? Part of it was that, and part of it was I was going to these dances all the time, you know, and I don't know how much that would have lasted until I got maybe in trouble for some reason or another, you know, you don't know. So, but we've never left each other or anything, and Mary was actually the one that was more stable than I was, you know. She was ahead of me as far as emotions go and everything. She told me if I ever leave, she's going to take the car and the house and everything, and so I can't afford to go to the rescue mission anymore, you know. And so she, It's always.
You're going to hear about that one later, Fred.
Did I make a boo-boo?
Well, I know you made some memories because you two both got to go on an incredible journey recently thanks to Utah Honor Flight. You went to Washington, D.C., and you got to visit the World War II Memorial. What was that like for you all these years later to experience that?
Well, you know, it was really something that I wanted to see. And so when we got to the World War II Memorial, they had the states on the thing. I went up there and we were just standing around talking, and some of the guys that were in the Marines were there, and they had been on Iwo Jima. And so we got to talking, and before long we were all crying. And, you know, we got to talking to each other, and it's kind of, grown men shouldn't cry, I don't think. And yet we were there, you know, and it was really upsetting to hear these guys sit there and couldn't hardly talk. You know, the Marines and that. And even though I was in the Navy, we were all in the same situation there at Iwo Jima and Okinawa both. And so it was really emotional to be there and talk to those guys. You know, I mean, it was completely different.
And I want to hear anything that you have to share about it, but there's three things that I have on my mind that I'm awfully curious about what it meant to you. Three things that I know you saw, and one of them's there at the World War II Memorial. You mentioned the states. They have those pillars with the name of every state. They also have a wall of gold stars signifying the more than 400,000 Americans who didn't make it home. Standing there and looking at that, hearing that fountain behind you and just looking at it, what did it mean to you?
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, talking about it, and we all have the same feelings, you know, because we all went through the same situation, except the Marines. They were in a terrible situation. And when you talk to them and that, you know, and then they get emotional, pretty soon you get emotional too.
Sure. The Gold Stars was one. Another that seems particularly relevant to you, we were talking about Mount Suribachi and the flag, and I'm sure they take you to the Marine Corps Memorial, and you see that giant statue, where if you walk around it, it looks like the flag is actually getting raised while you're there. What was that like, since you had been there at the original?
Well, we didn't, I don't remember us stopping at. They just went by and the
around.
Flag, and they were showing the flag. And the one that kind of haunted me was the Korean.
There's a picture of you standing in front of those soldiers in the Korean War Memorial.
Yeah. I had a friend. He was in the Marine Corps at that Chosun Reservoir. They threw a grenade in, and he laid on it.
Wow.
And he lost both legs, and he had damaged all of his body part. And he lived across the street from us, and he rode with me to work because he'd got a job at the government, too. A lot of that haunts you, you know. I mean, can you imagine laying on a grenade to save three or four other guys? I mean, I can't do that. Well, so I might be able to do it because you're not thinking. You're just
right.
Doing what you're reacting.
You never know until you're in that situation.
You're reacting.
So you thought of him at the Korean War Memorial. And speaking of selfless sacrifice, it strikes me, and I've been on these honor flight tours, and one of the parts of it, did you guys go to Arlington?
Yeah, we were talking about that this morning. We saw the Joe Louis thing and Lee Marvin.
Lee Marvin, the actor, and Joe Louis, the boxer, both buried there.
Yeah.
But so are a bunch of people that are not named. And you guys watched the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I've ever talked to someone who had a real compelling connection to that Tomb of the Unknown, but it seems to me with that unidentified pilot who saved your ship, the Tomb of the Unknown had to be a pretty special place.
Well, you know, you always think about what a waste.
Mm.
It's like the men we're losing now. You just had hope it never happened, but it did.
When you guys came home, you were hoping no one else would ever have to deal with that again.
That's true, but I've always tell people that people talk about peace. And I don't think we'll ever have peace, because when man first was able to throw a rock and hit somebody with a club, who even fighting, there has never been, I read up on that stuff. You know, I've got books on it, and I watch the programs and I read. And I don't know of any time in my lifetime have I ever seen real peace. And I don't think that as if I live to be 300 years old, I'll ever see peace. And I'm not talking about big wars, but just everything, fighting all over, no matter, and people are losing their lives. And America is stepping right in and losing more than anybody else. You know, we're losing our soldiers and that, and Marines and sailors all the time.
Well, peace is one thing, but preserving freedom and establishing freedom and liberating persecuted countries is a different story. And you guys accomplished that in World War II. On the honor flight, I'm curious what the most meaningful or satisfying or heartwarming element of that entire experience was for you.
Just meeting the guys, just
the other
talking
veterans.
To them. And there wasn't one, I don't know of one grouchy guy in that group. I swear to God, they were all so, and Mike and them had that so well planned, and that, you know, everything was right on schedule and everything else. Just being with those that group was really enjoyable. And I, you know, I belong to a group that we meet every Wednesday. It's all veterans, and it's no service. It's all services. And we just talk about things and talk about your experiences and things like that. I wouldn't have found out about the honor flight if I hadn't gone to those meetings and they told me about it. I wouldn't have known about it. Mm-hmm. And several of those guys had gone on those flights, and they told us about it, what it was.
How was your reception when you got back to Salt Lake?
Oh, you can't believe it. You can't believe it. If you do those things, you've got to warn the people to be at the airports to greet these guys. I mean, because that is uplifting to go through those airports and have them people applauding for you and saying things to you and everything. I mean, in my own mind, I think Utah is ahead of a lot of, I'll say areas, for vets. They have things going for the vets here all the time, like at the legislature the other day.
Yeah, you were just at the state capitol in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, and everybody, they were glad to see you. They were all glad to see you. They shake your hand and everything else, and it kind of makes you feel pretty good that there are areas and there are people that feel that way.
Does that make you feel like what you did mattered?
Yeah, it does. Because there for a long time, World War II vets, there was nothing happening. You didn't hear about hardly anything except on Veterans Day or something like that. But you never heard anything. Up here, you hear about it all the time. I mean, it's always brought up. And I'm glad Utah feels that way, because we're going to be gone pretty soon.
Well, that's why this show is here, so we can get it. So those of us who weren't around have an idea of what you did, and I want to make sure I say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything that, when you think back on it, that you're most proud of or you think is most important for us to understand today?
Well, most of what I'm proud of is what's happened in private, you know, life. My father was in World War I. I had a great-great-grandfather that was killed in the Civil War. My brother was in the Air Force. He was a crew chief. My other brother was over there in the Pacific the same time I was. He was on a destroyer, the Callahan. Mm. And my brother-in-law was out there. So my family has kind of been in these things, you know, not all wars, but just in service things. And no, I'm kind of proud of the way I lived. I haven't done anything wrong. I've always tried to play it straight. And I've had a happy marriage, and I enjoy that.
Is there something about your generation and the way America was 70 years ago that you think we could benefit from today?
Unity. Don't fight. I mean, what's all of this about, you know? I mean, it worries me, this country, sometimes about our military is, I don't think, as strong as it should be. We can't get along. We can't make a decision. We can't do this and we can't do that. Why just can't we get together and get it over with? And, you know, America could be like some of the other countries that went down, because of this, you know, not being organized, or, you know, and things like that. It just bothers me that we can't settle all of this. I just hope that we can find peace.
You and me both, my friend. Thank you for sharing from the heart today. You can find photos of Fred at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.